House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order March 17th. Let me first make a quick announcement that House Bill 2531 will not be worked today. There are some further conversations that are occurring on that, so we will carry that over to Thursday. Barbara, does that comprise the necessary notification? Okay, so any of you who might have been waiting for that, you're aware of our plan there. And with that, we'll proceed to open a public hearing on House Bill 2180. Betty, if you'd like to come up, and I don't know if you want to bring anybody with you while you're getting settled. Dave Antoff, join us. Great. Barbara, if you wouldn't mind giving us a summary, please.
HB 2180 establishes the Oregon Renewable Energy Grant Account and allows credit against income taxes for contributions to the account, authorizes the State Department of Energy to award grants for renewable energy projects, modifies the Business Energy Tax Credit, BETSI, to include certain recycling facilities, allows taxpayers to claim a Residential Energy Tax Credit, RETC, for a hydroelectric generating system, modifies provision for claiming a biomass tax credit, limits eligibility to biofuels that have been converted into fuels ready to use as energy in Oregon, revises biomass credit transfer provisions, allows credit where biofuel producer is also agricultural producer or biomass collector, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2010.
Thank you very much. You guys are conferring about who might go first. You can decide, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Antoff, the Governor's Sustainability Policy Advisor, and I'm going to let Betty walk through the details of the bill, but I just wanted to highlight again that this is part of the Governor's comprehensive package of bills working on climate change, and unfortunately, the bill that was dropped did not include a few of the provisions that we're going to talk about, the tax credit provisions, so what is before folks in the form of the proposed amendments will address both energy efficiency, industrial energy efficiency tax credits, and also tax credits for vehicles, the hybrid vehicle tax credit, and our proposals around trying to strengthen and put Oregon in the leadership position on the next generation of electric EV vehicles, plug-in and pure electric vehicles. And just to highlight...
Do we have those amendments?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. We haven't found them yet.
We don't have the amendments. We have the request for amendments.
Yeah, right. So understood. We're going to walk through the conceptual proposals. But we just wanted to tie this in the context of kind of where we're at in economic development in Oregon. We found with, as many of you know, that with the solar energy industry, that there was a combination of the business energy tax credits around the manufacturing process married with the consumer side of the credits around the BETSI and RETSI program that was really what sold folks on the importance of coming to Oregon and Solar World and other manufacturers that came here stressed the need for policy that was going to drive their product into the marketplace in the state where they were going to locate for manufacturing. We're seeing the same thing occurring in the EV electric vehicle sector, and we've got a number of folks that are looking at citing electric vehicle manufacturing and assembly facilities, and Oregon is coming up on their list, and they're stressing as well that the states that have incentives for consumers to purchase those products are going to stand out. So I just wanted to highlight that issue for the committee, and then Betty can talk through in more detail the substance.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betty Merrill, Assistant Director of Conservation for the Oregon Department of Energy. This bill comes to you as recommendations from both the Governor's Energy Efficiency Working Group and Renewable Energy Working Group. Two groups had met over the summer and came up with a number of recommendations. The first recommendation that's included in this bill is the establishment of the Oregon Renewable Energy Grant Account. This allows a tax credit against income taxes for contributions to an account. This would be similar to an account like the Cultural Trust. The fund would be established in the state treasury, and the primary purpose of the fund would be to provide grants for development of community-scale renewable energy resource projects in Oregon. The amount awarded would be limited to $1 million maximum in each calendar year. The second provision comes from the Energy Efficiency Working Group, and that's a recommendation to to increase the existing business energy tax credit for industrial process projects from 35% to 50%. This would allow energy to make investment in projects that they normally would not because the payback would be too long. So by providing a 50% incentive to them replacing the 35% incentive with the 50% incentive would get them to do more projects and therefore save more energy and be more competitive. The third initiative is the plug-in hybrid vehicles. This provision would include in both RETC, the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program, and the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, would put in plug-in hybrid vehicles as an alternative fuel vehicle. It would allow a maximum credit on the residential energy tax credit side of $5,000 and a 35% credit of the eligible incremental cost on the BETC side. The amendment also would recommend that the Department of Energy be able to determine the eligibility requirements within rule. This would allow the agency to come up with a sliding scale of incentives based on the type of technology and reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. It would also allow the agency some opportunity to look at technologies and market acceptance in moving vehicles in and out of the incentive program or decreasing their incentive as a technology is replaced by a newer technology. The last provision is a clarification that we've been working with the Department of Revenue for a while that revolves around biomass and biofuel credits. There was some confusion in the statutes that came out of, I believe, the 2007 session. And what these amendments would do is they would clarify tax credits for agricultural producers, biomass collectors, and biofuel producers. It also clarifies how they're certified, how they report, and who can get the credit.
Quick summary. I was an abrupt end. Even are there questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to listen and go through this with you. Can you explain to me how you balance the conversion of biomass into electricity with emissions? I mean, how does the Department of Energy look at that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, I'd like to ask Rick Wallace.
Please. You need to come to the desk, please, and identify yourself for the record, though. I'm sure you could answer very quickly. We want to make sure that everybody else gets the benefit of hearing your answer, too, please.
Okay. Rick Wallace, Oregon Department of Energy, Energy
Thanks.
Analyst. Representative Holby. Actually, we have some overarching language that doesn't allow us to do projects unless they're better than the standard, whatever that standard might be. And then we can't allow anything to go above and beyond that. They do set a standard for that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you set a standard by rule, an emission standard,
yes,
by rule. That then basically the biomass producer is generating electricity has to meet for them to be eligible for the tax credit.
Well, I thought you were talking about, there's two different ones there, and at this time, I don't know if there is a particular one. I think what you're talking about is the biomass one. DEQ would be the ones that would, they're the ones that would actually be allowing that energy facility to be sited and run. So we're going by their rules. It wouldn't run without their okay, their approval of that site.
Okay.
So as long as they have their approval, they can take in the biomass and get the credit that we have. They're still under their approval because we don't have those kind of things that we can do. You know, we're not able to go out and tell people that they can't do this or can't do that. Well, that's not under our purview, actually.
Okay. That clarifies it for me. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
I was just trying to clarify if this is a grant program or a loan program. It says it's a grant, but I thought I heard somebody talk about loans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, this would be a new grant program that would be based on donations. So donations that came into that fund would then be administered by the department as a grant for renewable projects.
So in essence, there are a couple of different parts, though. That's one part. Then there's also the tax credits for the facilities. And perhaps it's helpful to think of them in different chunks. Is that reasonable?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I'm not sure if you're talking about, there is an Oregon Renewable Energy Grant Program, which is proposed. What we're talking about on the biomass, biofuels, is an existing program under the Business Energy Tax Credit. This just clarifies the rules on who can take it and how they can take it. Currently, the Department of Revenue was having some difficulties in understanding who was a producer and who was a collector. So what we have done with them is agreed to certify folks as producers or collectors for the tax credit program.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, just to clarify the reason that the pieces of this bill are together, they're effectively all tax credit pieces of the Department of Energy's programs. So the new piece would be this grant fund to be created, and that would be created through donations that would get tax credits. But the rest are existing program, the existing Betsy and Retsy programs.
Okay, so we're talking about loans and credits and tax credits and grants and an existing program and also a new program in this bill. I'm just trying to make...
There should be a little clarification
details.
Here.
Okay.
Because the one is from, if you remember last session, 2210, that's a biomass collector, so on, program. And that really isn't through our office at this time. It was put directly, so someone would apply directly to revenue. They would do the program, and there's the transfer forms and so on. But the language was written such that there was confusion. When we said transfer product, you know, biomass from one entity to another, that means something to revenue that doesn't mean to us. And that means a money transfer. So that's what we're trying to clarify here, is that. So now you'll notice that we've struck out transfer and it says delivered. And there's quite a few things like that. So it's really a kind of some cleanup on some language there. That program would still primarily be housed in revenue. However, what we would do now is certify those credits, because right now they're not certified. And it's held up some of the... when someone wants to transfer those credits to someone else, it's a little difficult for them because no one's certified them. They're just kind of out there in limbo, and you have to really, you know, it's buyer beware, actually, in that market right now. This would strengthen that by certifying those.
Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should this all be in one bill? Is this the best way to do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, we would certainly be open to splitting up the components of this. But, and again, just not to belabor it, but there isn't a loan component to this proposed bill. There is tax credit components, and if it would be more clean to have the Betsy Redsy piece separate from the new grant fund, for instance, that certainly would be one avenue to take.
Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, two separate questions. First, is there an intention in using the grant fund for innovation and development of emerging technologies? Is there an intention to link that with some of the existing programs like Oregon Inc. or other programs that may exist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I think the intent is to try and create a new tool for helping get both community scale renewable energy projects kind of over the hump, the financing hump, and into development. That could include kind of new technology, R&D types of projects within that realm, and it could include conventional renewable projects that are just unable to get financing because of the scale, the size of the project, and how it's being developed. But so yes, I think the answer would be it's intended to include those types of new technology programs.
I heard you say $1 million annually. Was that the cap on the fund or the allocations or grants? But what comes in or what goes out, which is the limit, or maybe it's both?
The Mr. Chair, it's a cap on the what comes in through the donations. We're trying to create some certainty around how much could and whether $1 million when $1 million would come through the program is very debatable. It could be years. It could be
understood
soon.
Representative Bailey, you had another question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. On a different line of questioning, could you go over again the rationale for including small-scale hydro in this proposal?
You want me to? Or?
All right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, currently small-scale hydro was not included in our program, and we've had a recent interest shown in doing a small-scale hydro. So for, like, irrigation districts, those kinds of projects. So that's why we're including it here.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Forgive me, I wasn't here last session. Do you happen to know, is hydro included in our renewable portfolio standard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, it's a timely question. The small-scale hydro is included in the RPS. But for existing systems, there was a limitation to utility-owned systems. And so there is some conversation this session about whether that should be extended to non-utility-owned systems like irrigation districts and others. But for new projects, it's included within the RPS.
For utility-owned or
either,
for everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
Going
thank
forward.
You.
Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, would you anticipate that the department would have any part in promoting the program and suggesting the shift of these of taxpayers' money or a business's money into this account? In other words, how does the public at large learn about this, and who is prompting the taxpayer to send the money to make a donation of money rather than pay it as tax?
Seems you've asked a good question, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. We have not talked in detail about how it would be marketed. I think the model was something along the lines of the Cultural Trust to try and create awareness of the opportunity to make a donation to move renewable energy forward. The specific mechanisms for how to do that we have not developed. And that's in part why we put the $1 million cap on the initial piece of the program was to provide certainty that it wasn't going to get beyond the scope of in terms of how much impact on the general fund that could lead to, to minimize that. Whether we're able to get significant donations sooner than later would be largely probably be based on how much awareness there was, and that's not provided for.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious about how the department would view its obligation or not to tell the taxpayers about this opportunity to shift their money from, let's say, general fund dollars to this device. I'm just interested in knowing if we at the legislature are basically delegating the opportunity to some department to shift spending, because you really could. That's what we're really, and I just wondered how much money the department would allocate to folks to get on the phone and or publish or do whatever you're going to do to get the money to go into this account.
Chairman Reed, Representative Benz, when this proposal came forward, and I know the fiscal is not completed because we did all the amendments, we did go through a thought process of sort of putting this in the light of designing after the Cultural Trust, where you're doing minimal staffing, you're doing like a website, you would be donating online. The reason it was limited to $1 million was specifically to contain the revenue impact and see how the program went forward. So, and they, for the record, the department does not receive general funds.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I would just add, I think the thinking is initially, largely this would be done maybe with a link on a website, but largely through word of mouth. But for folks that really are energy fans and want to see renewable energy development occur in the state, that they would start to, emails would start to percolate, and people become aware of this as an option for their directed dollars.
One follow-up. It's actually their directed dollars. Like those of on the revenue committee would say our directed dollars. thank you.
Appreciate that refinement. Yeah. Representative Holby?
thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking for a clarification on the hydroelectric, you know, because you were mentioning water districts, irrigation districts, and as I'm reading the summary, it's talking about a residential energy tax credit for those hydroelectric generating systems. Where's the line? What makes it a like in the case of an irrigation district, why isn't that a business energy tax credit instead of a residential energy tax credit? Or, I mean, where's the line between the two?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, a lot of it has to do with size and the use of the property. If someone were to have a small waterway and irrigation canal on their personal land and they put in a small in-stream hydro there, it would be a residential energy tax credit versus a business purchasing one for generation of income or offsetting their energy. So it really depends on the use of the particular project.
So in the case of the irrigation district, follow-up, Mr. Chair, that you mentioned in reference to the residential energy tax credit, that's used by a lot of different people, and it would still qualify for the residential energy tax credit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, I misspoke. The an irrigation district would most likely fall under the business energy tax credit provision.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that the way the Section 5 reads, it's that the awards in a calendar year may not exceed $1 million, but that would not be a restriction on the amount contributed to the account. So there really is no lid on the amount that could be contributed. Am I right there?
It was a revenue impact, Dave.
That's a
very good
question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, I believe you're correct. The intent was that we would not be taking in more than $1 million nor sending out more than $1 million.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. No questions, Representative Thatcher?
Excuse me. Talking about Betsy, I heard there's quite a backlog of applications. Are we piling on more through this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, we had a huge backlog last summer. We had more than about 800 applications in the backlog. Currently, we've worked our backlog down 400 to 500. We've changed, streamlined processes. We've made progress. We've changed processes significantly so that we can handle applications more quickly. Are we increasing? We will increase some tax credits in terms of the business energy tax credits for industrial processes. We don't expect to see a huge number of those, probably in the handful, you know, 10, maybe 12 of those a year. In terms of looking at the tax credits on the plug-in hybrid vehicles, that would be sort of a wash with where we are today and allowing us the ability to do a sliding scale and evaluating technologies and phasing out one technology, bringing new technologies on board. It allows you a little more flexibility in controlling your revenue impacts on, say, plug-in hybrid vehicles. So when you're seeing a new technology that you're putting at a $5,000 level, you're going to lower the incentives and eventually phase out an older technology. So I think you're going to see a little increase, but not a huge increase here. You're shifting technologies.
I'll look.
Okay. Well, okay, shifting technologies, and I'm hearing that there's going to be about 10 or 12 projects per year, and you're capping it at $1 million, so roughly $100,000 per project that is coming out of the fund, right? The tax credit, whatever this program is. There's so many programs out there. Anyway, are you keeping track of the jobs that are being created through these different programs, specifically this one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I think we've confused you on the grant program and the tax credit programs. I was talking about the BEPSI tax credit, business energy tax credit for the industrial programs. On the grant program, renewable energy grant program, we have no idea at this point how many projects would come forward for those grants and how many would be selected for those grants.
Nor how much money might be in the fund, right?
Correct.
But back to the BEPSI, how many jobs have been produced through this program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, unfortunately I forgot to bring my Echo Northwest report
through the BEPSI
for
generally,
this year.
Right. I didn't bring it either, but we did have that the hearing on the large one. We can get that back to you.
That was fine. Thank you.
Representative Holby?
Just one more, and I apologize if you already addressed this. There's been a lot of interest in including three-wheeled electric automobiles, I guess, in the definition of the plug-in hybrid for the purposes of this tax credit. Has that been discussed? Because I know there are, I'm aware of at least five or six different companies in Oregon that are making these three-wheeled electric vehicles quite cheaply and are comparatively to some of the standard four-wheel models we're aware of from overseas and whatnot.
Before we have an answer to that question, you give me a nice segue to note for the committee that we did receive an email from Brent Bolton of EcoSpeed that's in your packets making a similar point. I'd love to hear your answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Polvey, we, the Governor's offices and the Department of Energy, have heard quite a bit of interest from three-wheelers, and what's being proposed is to give the Department of Energy the discretion to develop the scale for both kind of based on performance of the vehicle in terms of what the emissions reductions are because of the electrification and the cost of the vehicle, and create the appropriate incentive for that sliding scale. So a $30,000 vehicle would likely not get the same credit as a $10,000 vehicle. But that's what we're proposing, is to have the flexibility to try and tailor that program so we're able to adjust and make sure that we're maximizing the benefits of the programming and really meeting market demands and opportunities in the state. There are, as you've noted, some interest in, I think, some legislators to specifically state in the tax credit what it will be for various vehicles. And that would be another approach. But we think that, like with the appliance efficiency standards, it's been very beneficial for the department to be able to adjust that over time to make sure that we're kind of continue to move the market and most efficiently utilize the credit. But the short answer is yes, those would be included within the program.
Other questions, Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, following on Representative Holvey's question, is that the definition in Section 7 B? Section 7.3B. Is it your interpretation that change to that section would allow for the inclusion of
bottom of page 4? Right?
Excuse me, bottom of page 4. For the inclusion of alternative vehicles that may be three-wheeled or otherwise.
I'm sorry, are you looking in the legislation?
Yes. Bottom of page 4, B starts on line 37.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, that's the provision in the concept paper that Ms. Merrill walked through is what would specifically address, create the authority for the agency to develop the program for plug-in and pure electrics. It wasn't included in the original version of the bill that came out. So we're trying to correct that in terms of the amendments that would go into the bill.
Any questions? Did you have a follow-up, Representative Bailey? You looked like you might have. If you're thinking
Mr. Chair, can somebody point out exactly where they're reading from, or so I'm on the same page?
Well, the question Representative Bailey was asking about was on the bottom of page 4 of the bill, line 37, there's a subsection B, which appears to propose a definition. And then I think Ms. Merrill and Mr. Vantoff are referring to a spot in the amendment requests, which is also in our packet. I'm not certain where that was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I'm sorry, it's confusing. We should have had the amendments ready to walk through, but essentially, it's by combining what's in the section you referred to, Representative Bailey, 7B, with what we're proposing in the March 9 document that Ms. Merrill distributed.
And can you point out where that is?
That's on the first page under the hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and alternative fuel vehicles.
Okay, thank you. So bottom of that page.
That was him to have.
Has it been? They have. So those combinations that adjusts the upper level of the tax credit that the agency will be authorized to issue per vehicle, and creates the authority for the sliding scale to be created. And when we have the amended version of the bill, it'd be easier to show it all together.
Are we on?
Yes, we are.
Okay, we'll come back to order. And I've forgotten some of the questions, but you guys haven't, so let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I believe the question was, to what extent does the Section 7, Sub B, Line 37 through 41, what does that provide in comparison to what's being proposed in the amendments? And essentially, the first question is for plug-ins and pure electrics right now, do they qualify for the tax credit? Yes, they do. And we've given out credits for those vehicles to date. You know, very, very few because there's not a lot out there. But yes, what under the current statute, the department doesn't have any discretion to develop a sliding scale based on the regard to the energy consumption savings of the vehicle. So anything that's a plug-in or a pure electric, it's the same credit. There's no establishing that credit based on the performance of the vehicle. Because they're not all the same, you know. It'll depend in terms of how far the charge lasts and various factors. So this would provide that added discretion to develop a scale within that credit program for the vehicles and their performance, and factoring in cost, which again we compare to their authority under the appliance efficiency standards and the ability to adjust those to maximize benefits of the program. And then the second piece that is necessary is the authorization for them to go to the $5,000 credit as the top of the scale for these tax credit for the tax credit program. Is that clear or less clear?
And the point that it can be adjusted based on what's happening in the market as well, right?
Correct.
Very important element, seems to me. Other questions? Seems like maybe we've exhausted our questions of you. Thank you very much.
You.
We have a number of people who have signed up to testify. It does not appear that anyone is from more than 100 miles away, so we'll just proceed down the list. And I'll call three people at a time just so we can maximize the chairs that are there. Gary Gronke, I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Clifford Schrock. And I'm a little worried about pronouncing this one correctly. Max Schader Pishin. Not sure if I got at all close, but please come forward. Whomever would like to start, glad to hear from you. You get to decide who starts.
Okay, I'm Mr. Chairman, I'm in committee. I'm Gary Gronke from the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association. So I have an all-electric car, and I also have a plug-in Prius over the last year. So I just wanted to reinforce the tax credit for plug-in hybrids and battery electrics. What you're doing is a very significant thing. And first of all, the vehicles are 3 to 4 times more efficient at creating transportation than heat engine-based cars. And the more efficient electric cars are, then the less pollution, So all this derives from being electric. But to date, the automakers have not made vehicles that you can actually fuel directly from the electric grid. You always had to put in gasoline. And while electricity is the only alternative fuel that you get back when you go downhill, that's essentially where all the electricity was coming from in today's hybrid vehicles. As good as they were, they're still not good enough to take us to the next step. So in my second slide, I talk about the sun-to-wheels efficiency of vehicles. And so first of all, petroleum is essentially capital. We're depleting capital that's taken 500 million years to accumulate, and the efficiency of only 1/1 trillionth, roughly, of that energy that comes from the sun, our energy income, actually makes it into the fossil fuels. Whereas with an electric vehicle, once people have electric vehicles that plug in, they themselves, without even the cooperation of the utility company, can simply put solar panels on their garage. So on my garage, I can put 3 kilowatts and go 72 miles every day. So the efficiency at which they are able to convert sunlight into motion is actually in the teens, which is an order of magnitude better than biofuels. So I asked various biofuel people how much of the sun's energy actually makes it into their fuel, and the answer was 1 to 2%. And then, of course, 80 to 90% of that is wasted in the heat engine and escapes as heat, doesn't actually make you go. So the efficiency of many other alternative fuels is far less. So it's very important to make the step to allow vehicles to plug in, to use electricity directly.
Mr. Grunke, may I ask you to, I'm worried about the time. We have a number of people who are signed up in several of the bills, so if you wouldn't, we appreciate your presentation on paper here, and perhaps if you could summarize in just a couple of minutes, that'd be very helpful.
Right, so I have a section on how it interacts with the renewable power on the grid, and the answer is it makes it pay off better because it provides storage for electricity, so these intermittent resources of wind and solar, the wind blowing all night when no one uses electricity, actually enhances their payback. And so basically, the real problem is not that we're running out of fossil fuels, it's that we haven't done a very good job of living off of our energy income, and electric vehicles are a crucial step at being able to do that. And by the way, the CO2 emissions will drop significantly as a result. So thank you.
That was very quick. Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Clifford Schrock, and I am a partner in Terra EV, a startup company in Portland that recycles light trucks by converting them to 100% plug-in electric vehicles. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you today on 2180. As background, Portland and the state have significant interest in electric vehicles as well as a cluster of companies that provide various electric vehicle components and technologies. Oregon's not only a market for EVs, but it could be a significant player in the supply of components, technology, and the production of new and converted vehicles for this market. In Section 7 of the bill, electric vehicles are called out as one of the alternative fuel vehicles, and the bill appears to cover the subjects of incentives for converted vehicles and addresses the charging and refueling facilities. It's very important that the cost of converting vehicles to electric power as incentive help, since the initial conversion cost of a full-size highway vehicle such as we produce is significant, in excess of $10,000. I'd like to point out that the benefit over 5 years of such an electric vehicle is that it will cost about half to operate compared to a gas vehicle and largely pay for itself in fuel and maintenance savings. And in addition, the most significant benefit is zero pollution. We support this bill in the sections that apply to electric vehicles and charging infrastructure. I want to close by saying we fully recognize that electric vehicles are not a universal solution. If you live in rural Oregon, drive hundreds of miles each week, as some of our legislators do, consider a hybrid. Consider driving a hybrid. But in the cities, masses of people commuting or conducting their daily business, driving 50 miles per day or less, sitting at stoplights, are currently consuming tens of thousands of gallons of fossil fuel weekly, converting it to pollution. This is the market for the electric vehicle, and we need thousands of them in our cities today as we meet here. I ask that you support this bill for this reason alone, and one way to think of it is we run the electric vehicles in town, and that's more fossil fuel for rural Oregon to conduct their business. Our state could be an early adopter of EVs and could also be a world leader in jobs, education, and technology for electric vehicles. I hope this gives you some small idea of the opportunity that may await us as we reinvent our ideas about transportation in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your last paragraph particularly. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Max Shader-Biashin. I'm a co-founder of Barefoot Motors. We design and assemble 100% electric plug-in off-road utility vehicles. We moved the base of our business to Ashland in the fall of 2008, given how forward-thinking we saw Oregon being and becoming a significant center of electric vehicles. The main message of my testimony today is to encourage you to clarify or, if need be, change the definition of alternative fuel vehicle to ensure the electric utility vehicles that we produce can help accomplish the goals of HB 2180. As defined under Section 8, our vehicles are indeed vehicles that are used primarily in connection with the conduct of a trade or business, primarily agriculture, farmers, that is manufactured to use alternative fuel, electricity. However, according to the Department of Energy website, the application for the energy tax credit requires vehicles to be licensed for roadway use by the Oregon DMV. Why is it important to consider our utility vehicles as part of HB 2180? One premise of HB 2180, as I understand it, is to encourage the commercialization of electric drive technologies and to encourage that in the state of Oregon. Barefoot Motors vehicles do just that. One, by using components that can be used in on-road vehicles, by serving a large market and hence having a large impact, immediate impact, and three, by encouraging the replacement of relatively polluting forms of transportation, pollution being noise and emissions. Regarding one, our critical vehicle components are a motor, controller, batteries, and chargers. They generate over 60 horsepower and can be used to drive on-road vehicles over 100 miles per hour. The batteries we are using in our vehicles is the same chemistry that GM will be using in the GM Volt. The more these components are used, the more confidence suppliers will have to make investments in manufacturing, and the more invested in producing the components, the quicker their costs will come down. With respect to two, serving a larger market, I think it will surprise some of you to know that there are over 1 million ATVs sold in the U.S. every year. That's a $6 billion market. Close to half of those are specifically used for utility applications on farms, to land managers, and industrial sites. Given the technology already available today in electric drive, there is no reason why 75% of these applications cannot come from electric vehicles. We did a survey of farmers in California. On average, they have 4 to 5 ATVs per farm. In Oregon, there are 36,553 farms. That's a fair estimate to say there's about 125,000 to 150,000 ATVs in Oregon agriculture use today. And this leads to point three, replacing relatively polluting transportation and its impact. An ATV four-stroke engine is over 10 times more polluting than a car engine. Adjusting for the mileage driven, replacing one gas ATV with our electric ATV is like taking 3 to 4 cars off the road. By including our vehicles in the definition for alternative fuel vehicles, you have an easy path to removing the equivalent of 500,000 cars off of Oregon's roads. If timing is important to you, if you share the sense of urgency to move our society away from oil, please note that you do not have to wait the 2 or 3 years for our vehicles to become available. Our vehicles are being tested now and will be delivered to customers in June and July. Our utility vehicles are designed in Oregon. They're built in Oregon with Oregon know-how, a local supply chain, and labor. I hope you can change the definition of alternative fuel vehicles so that Barefoot Motors can help commercialize the technology that HB 2180 is encouraging to seed in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have just a couple minutes for questions if there are any for this panel. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question for all of you, by the way. Great name. It's the first time I've heard of your company. I have an image of Fred and Barney.
Our next project is called Project Flintstone.
Excellent. I knew you were ahead of me.
That's on.
Just say a word, if you would, about safety and strength in your industry, in terms of the vehicle.
I'd like to address that. One of the most critical and potentially dangerous factors with conversion vehicles is fly-by-night type conversions. We do our strictly engineered, bring the vehicle back to full gross vehicle weight, national highway standards, weight, balance, suspension, and brakes. And that's going to be a very important factor, and it might even be a key in legislation saying that not every conversion vehicle, for example, a conversion vehicle must meet the original highway standards under which it was certified.
So, of course, we substitute the volatile gasoline with high voltage electronics and high current electronics. So I just gave a talk, EV 101, last Thursday, for people who are hobbyists doing this themselves. We want them to stay alive. But basically, once you disconnect the higher voltage into small segments, it's quite safe. It will not electrocute you. People working on vehicles need to take their rings off, but we'll learn how to service them. I mean, of course, obviously, most of the companies like Nissan would have somebody service it for you, and it wouldn't be a problem for the normal person. I don't know if you've ever done electrical work versus plumbing, but I have a lot less problem with the electricity if I have a nice, tight connection there, whereas plumbing seems to leak a lot. So generally, they can be a lot safer. The three-wheeled vehicles, of course, do not meet crash standards. A few companies, but Tesla is one of the companies that actually did meet the crash standards for a new vehicle in record time. But conversions typically are going to be much safer. The Ford EV Ranger had a 5-star crash rating. The gas version had only a 4-star crash rating because they had a very hefty battery box that added a lot more stability to the chassis. The three-wheelers are essentially motorcycles, classified as motorcycles. They are a very safe motorcycle. They're not as safe as a car. So the buyer should take that into consideration, of course. The four-wheeled electric vehicles, which are limited to NEV speeds, 25 miles an hour, roads less than 35. In Washington, they've upped both those numbers by 10 miles per hour, so that at least they're not passed by bicycles. Those do not meet the crash testing, so various people have proposed intermediate kinds of vehicles with some safety features, but still not the same requirements as a freeway-capable vehicle.
May I make three quick points, Chair?
Very quickly, please.
Yeah. First of all, with respect to quality and power, the strength of electric vehicle technology is that it has power, and that's why we've matched our vehicle to a specific application that is a workhorse application, so it fits exactly. We get better payload, better towing capacity than an existing gas ATV without the emissions. The other thing that I think that's really important to know on the safety issue, I will throw the question back to you, is in today's society, if you were expected to approve at every other corner to put in underground the most cancerous liquid that exists in mankind, and you were asked to approve that, you would say no today, and that's benzene, and that's in gasoline. So you need to move people away from gasoline. And that's why our vehicles are relatively unique because, yes, you need to go through crash testing. And that's very important for on-road vehicle safety, no doubt about it. But it takes 2 or 3 years to go through that and takes about $200 and $500 million. You're talking here with HB 2180 to encourage electric drive technology. Here's a way, by helping to redefine the definition of alternative fuel vehicles, to help that technology get out there. And you can do that in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. If there aren't any other questions for this panel, very quickly, Representative Thatcher, we get six other people. I want to make sure we get in. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll throw this out to anybody else that's coming up here from a business. And I don't know how to ask this question without possibly sounding offensive, and so forgive me, please. What got you into this business
were there incentives in place already for you to get into this business? Maybe just a quick...
Very quick, please.
Chairman Reed, Senator Thatcher, I got this into this business because it's the right thing to do. And we built our business model on the premise that, no, we don't expect and don't want to rely on government assistance. Maybe an oxymoron to be here today. But having said that, you can help accelerate what we're trying to do by encouraging people, providing a differential or some funding in the differential of the cost delta. It is more expensive for our vehicle. It's about 25 to 30% more expensive. You can help us accelerate. Instead of selling 100 this year, we can do 250 if you can help close that delta. Just like plasma TVs, once you have a bigger market, they've gone from thousands of dollars to hundreds of dollars.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you being here.
Ditto.
Okay. Excellent. Next three people on my list. Chris, I think it's Baker or Bacher. Not sure if that's correct. Great. Suzanne Lita-Lou and Ray Wilkerson, please. Looks like you're submitting written testimony. We're glad to have that, and we will read it. So if you can just summarize, that'd be terrific, too. And since you sat down first, why don't you go ahead?
Very well. Thank you, Committee Chair Reed, and the committee members for hearing me today. I'm, for the record, I'm President and Chief Strategy Officer. Chief Strategy Officer for Synchromotive. We build and supply EV controllers and power management systems for electric vehicle and electric vehicle charging stations. The RTC for hybrid vehicles was very important, making Oregon the nation's leader in hybrid vehicle adoption. It was an important piece, positively supporting the behavior, and we have the opportunity to keep that momentum going and further the electrification of passenger travel. Plug-in hybrids and full battery electric vehicles are coming, and they need to be supported. As plug-in hybrids and battery electrics gain acceptance and market share, they will help decrease our dependency on foreign oil and lower our overall emissions. There's another benefit that cannot be overlooked for Oregon specifically, and that is economic. Unlike hybrid vehicles, which almost exclusively come from overseas, many components and infrastructure components that would be required to support the new vehicles could come from Oregon companies creating jobs and real opportunities right here at home. There are several companies in Oregon that may even build and supply the vehicles themselves. We've already heard from one of those or two of those. The onset of the plug-ins and battery electric vehicles will support Oregon's growth in existing industries, including fabrication, software design, installation, and assemblers. New industries coming to Oregon could be in the form of engineering, design, and component manufacturing. And it could support faltering segments, including shipping and port facilities, auto sales, and home sales with reborn demand. Synchromotive is just one clean tech startup in Oregon. We got our start providing power, electronics, and control to the nascent electric vehicle industry. With our partner Shore Power's background in truck stop electrification, we have used our collective skills to build and supply charging stations to service the coming vehicles. We have already sold stations for use here and on the East Coast. The opportunity is knocking. These vehicles of tomorrow may be built by companies right here in Oregon. Conversely, they may come through our own port from Asia, and in both cases, providing very real and long-term family jobs. By the end of next year, there may be as many as 150 such vehicles in the United States alone. By 2018, that number could be over 15 million, and that's only 6% of the cars currently on the road in the U.S., representing a potential 90 million tons of carbon not put into the atmosphere. We might realize this opportunity to grow Oregon by taking what we've learned and what worked with hybrids and continue to embrace the change and the future. We urge your support for Oregon growth by supporting the adoption of electrically fueled transportation. And I might add, for additional consideration, we would support three-wheel and plug-in hybrid conversions. There will be 2 million of those on the road by the end of next year. And the conversion of hybrids to a plug-in hybrid is a modest change. It definitely would be representing your sliding scale that you were speaking to, but it's very reasonable to convert existing fleets to a plug-in fleet, but that might be worth considering supporting. And additionally, the internal combustion engine conversions that Mr. Schrock had addressed earlier, too. We get a lot of interest from municipalities to take vehicles getting close to retirement and keep them in service for another 5 or 6 years at a fraction of the cost of buying a new vehicle. Thank you very much, committee chair and committee members.
Thank you. Edley Liu. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Lita Liu. I'm the Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project, and I'm here today on behalf of RNP and on behalf of the Healthy Climate Partnership. The Healthy Climate Partnership is a broad coalition of consumer, environmental, faith, and business organizations that is working together on a variety of different tools to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions here in the state. And this particular bill is another tool in the toolbox that helps us get there. I think the specific component that I've worked on personally is through the Renewable Energy Working Group, and that's the Community Renewable Energy Grant Program. But as we've heard from the electric vehicle community, you know, there's several pieces of this bill that are significant for transitioning toward a cleaner economy. And I think just to highlight the renewable energy grant component, you know, it's clear that we have a very good tax credit system in place, and one of the benefits of the grant program is that it provides a way, it's a simple tool for individuals and corporations to direct their tax credit to provide a fund, to establish a fund that can then go directly to community renewable energy projects. So in the RUG, we talked about how do we find ways to expand the pool of pass-through partners so that more renewable energy projects can take advantage of the tax credit system that we have in place, especially because many project owners or project developers don't have tax liability themselves. So this is a way of ensuring that those other projects where the owner or the developer doesn't have tax liability can work with a fund that essentially acts as the pass-through partner. There's not much revenue projected in this bill. It's about $1 million. So it's actually quite a small program, but we think it's an important step forward. Thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Wilkerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, representing private forest landowners. Appreciate the brief time. I submitted a written statement. Our interest in this bill is in Sections 9 and 10, the biomass tax credit sections. We don't produce any exotic new vehicles, but we do grow trees, which creates a tremendous amount of biomass that can be converted to bioenergy, and so we believe that we have a strong interest in renewable energy and believe we can be a big part of the meeting Oregon's renewable energy needs in the future through that biomass function. I think the bill itself is intended to modify House Bill 2210 from at least Sections 9 and 10 from 2210 for the 2007 session and a few glitches that were discovered during the interim. The change of the word transfers to delivers is a big step in the right direction there to address some of the issues that the Department of Revenue raised during the interim. And from our written statement, and I'm pinch hitting today for Lake Cannon on our staff who wasn't able to be here today. He's our expert on this, but he asked me to submit this, which I'm obviously happy to do. There's a couple other issues we've identified in our written statement. One would be the certification of biomass tax credits, and I believe the first panel mentioned that issue may be addressed in the amendments that are forthcoming. And then there's a couple of other things we would like to have considered relating to the way biomass tax credits themselves are sold or transferred with the goal of improving their marketability and making the program work as intended. So if we could continue to work with you, Mr. Chairman, and when we get a chance to see the amendments, take a look at them and maybe provide some feedback on that, we'd be grateful.
We appreciate that. Thanks for bringing your suggestions.
Thank you.
And thank you all for being brief. Unless anyone is quickly in getting any interest in questions, we'll excuse you. Appreciate your testimony. We have three more people to be heard on this bill. We have about 5 minutes or so. One of our colleagues is waiting patiently for an opportunity to testify on a bill he's here for. So three people, Jody Weiser, John Thornton, and North Cheatham, if you can all be as brief as you possibly can be, we can get on to our other bill and our good colleague. So whoever sits down first gets to start, please.
Hello, committee chair and committee members. My name is John Thornton. I'm with Porting Electric Vehicles in Portland, Oregon. I believe we need a chance to move our public policy from, move our economy from fossil fuel to one that uses renewable energy. One of the best ways to do this is with deployment of electric cars. This solution will reduce our environmental impacts based on carbon and pollutants reduction, reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and potentially to generate new jobs here in Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2180's amendment to sunset the energy tax credit for hybrid vehicles while replacing with an attribute-based incentive for plug-in electric vehicles based on petroleum reduction, energy efficiency, and greenhouse gas reduction. Such an amendment would incent transformation of plug-in hybrid vehicles and fully electric vehicles as they come to market, thereby enabling Oregon to lead in clean transportation. For consideration when it comes time for rulemaking, I am recommending a portion of the tax credit incentive to be based on the capability for vehicles to be automatically recharged at off-peak times. This functionality, often referred to as smart charging, encourages electric vehicle charging when excess electrical generation capacity is most prevalent, thereby making use of our intermittent wind generation resources. I am strongly advocating for policy and market incentives to shift EV charging to off-peak times and maximize the use of renewables, thereby avoiding capacity constraints during peak times. Also, when it comes time for rulemaking, I'm emphasizing an attribute-based incentive on petroleum reduction, energy efficiency, and elimination of pollutants. I'm strongly advocating for such attribute-based criteria to embrace such non-traditional vehicles as included in House Bill 2120, Sections 24 through 27. Such medium-speed electric vehicles would be incented in an equivalent manner as the same diet as other four-wheel vehicles. After all, for any shorter local trips made in such medium-speed vehicles, you get the same benefit as you would in a fully functional, highway-capable vehicle. As Vice President of Porting Electric Vehicles, I can state that my company is well-positioned to bring these vehicles to market fully 100% electric and capable of traveling at speeds up to 35 miles an hour on road. Such vehicles offer affordable choices for Oregon's residents and businesses alike to reduce environmental impact and our petroleum usage. These vehicles are a viable replacement for our fuel-burning vehicles in many instances, particularly in second vehicle applications. Porting Electric Vehicles is an Oregon-based company founded in 2005. Porting is one amongst many Oregon companies developing innovative clean transportation in components, vehicles, and services. With jobs being shed in traditional industries, both locally and nationally, Oregon's emerging industry cluster has the potential to create new jobs locally throughout the supply chain. I strongly encourage policy and support to create such new clean transportation sector-related jobs. While there's no need to linger on fallout in today's challenging economy for businesses of all sizes, support for our emergent cluster is crucial. I would also like to mention the highly competitive situation as various regions around the world are actively recruiting clean vehicle jobs. As a native Oregonian, I'm strongly encouraging policies to go beyond end-user incentives and create policies to attract and grow local jobs in this manufacturing sector. If you have any questions or comments, I'll be happy to take them at the end. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cheeto.
Chair Reed, and members of the House Committee, I am North Cheatham. I'm from Hood River. I speak on matters relating to clean energy, relating to the public interest as I see it. And I'm here because we have a number of experts in this room in various technologies. I'm always very impressed. I have not heard from anyone up here with experience in actually applying for and experiencing what the Betsy tax is. I am one of those people, and I thought I would just relate my experience to you folks to show you how this works, how it fits in with things. In 2004, I erected on my farm a 90-kilowatt wind turbine that's enough to generate power for about 9 or 10 households. The outlay, cash outlay on that was about $70,000. Today it would be higher than that. Mine was a refurbished turbine. To cut to the chase here, my incentive packages were green tags, which basically required the utilities to pay me the premium residential rate for power as opposed to the wholesale price. Energy Trust, which put up some of the investment capital up front, and also the Betsy tax and tax credit. And that was a primary incentive. And here is why. My investment in the project cost $70,000. My revenue stream from that project, I have since sold it, but while I had it, was about $1,500 a year. Not sufficient to justify that type of investment. The Betsy tax really helped me, but I was a large landholder. I was in a windy area. I had the motivation and the awareness of what was out there, and at that time the Betsy program was fairly targeted. And now what we're trying to do is expand that program to all kinds of different projects and technologies, manufacturers of all kinds that are related to renewable resources and efficiencies. What I'm saying is that, as I see it, the public interest is best served by this move. There is a tremendous amount of support out there for renewable energy projects, but all too often people are not able to capitalize on that because of circumstances. This extends those opportunities drastically. Now, the next thing, and I'll be very brief here, I realize I'm taking more time than I should. Representative Bailey, Thatcher, and Benz, I heard you all originally express some confusion over this bill. Yes, I share that confusion. It is a highly complicated, large bill. It taking two different things here, the renewable energy grant account and Betsy, which are not the same, and putting them into one big hat and stirring it up, and hopefully everybody can make sense out of it. Okay, the reason the renewable energy grant program is so important is because in the past, in fact, even in the 25% renewable power by 2025, that bill, there was a carve out, a soft carve out for community wind projects. This has, in fact, not been as successful as they had hoped, because the smaller projects don't have the resources for the site studies, the permits, and so forth. All these things you have to put up first before you can actually get power to justify your project. This renewable energy grant account, as I see it, would really fuel those kinds of projects instead of just channeling everything into the big utilities like Horizon and PGE and FPL and so forth. This is a good thing. This is a good thing. I'll leave it right there because I know that there's a lot of people in this room that would like to speak, and I will yield at this point.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. Ms. Weiser.
Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. I'm going to speak off my notes, but to three specific points in there. The only piece of this bill that I want to speak to is the creation of the Oregon Renewable Energy Grant account by doing it with a tax credit. I totally, and our organization totally believes that tax credits are not the best way to help schools and nonprofits and municipalities get solar panels, for instance, on top of their roofs, or automobiles or anything else, because they don't have a tax need, and the market for selling them is not really a valuable part of our economy. So having a grant program makes huge sense, and in fact we do have a grant program with the Energy Trust of Oregon, and there's some grant programs within the department now. Our concern is not that there shouldn't be a grant program, because there need to be either feed-in tariffs or a grant program available. Our problem is that we're creating it with a tax credit, and that tax credit has no sunset on it. It has no fences around how big it could be. You say you only want $1 million, but what if $20 million comes in 4 years from now? What do you do with that? Do you do what we just did with the cultural trust and pull the money back out and go against what the citizens thought they were doing? Or do you take responsibility for deciding we want a grant program and we're going to fund it through ways and means the way we fund other programs we know are essential? Because in the long run, it's all the same money. That's the point. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and for being brief. I appreciate your comments, especially about a sunset. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much for being here. Thanks for a good discussion on the bill and all its various parts. We're obviously continuing the conversation and work on the amendments, and I suspect it will be back before us, hopefully without much delay. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2180 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2809. Thank you very much for your patience, Representative Huffman, if you'd like to come forward. And I think, Mr. Keto, you were also signed up to help enlighten us on this bill.
Is that right?
I don't have that.
No, it's Mr. Tashman.
Ah, sorry. Excuse me. Please, gentlemen.
And I'll make that correction in a second.
All right.
Thank you, Chair Reed, committee members. For the record, I'm John Huffman, State Representative for District 59. I would love to talk with you guys this afternoon about a lively and compelling topic. However, urban renewal's on the agenda, so we'll forego that. And since I could baffle you with everything I don't know about urban renewal, I brought my friend from the Dalles community and Economic Development Director, Dan Durow. And Jeff Tashman is actually the consultant for the Dalles, and Dan was the one that brought this bill forward. And so I'm going to exit myself and move on to other meetings and turn. You guys will be in the capable hands of Dan Durow.
Appreciate you being here and appreciate your patience. Thanks very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Durow, if you can help us get oriented a bit, and I imagine we'll have some questions.
Yes. Terry, for the record, my name is Dan Durow. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of the Dalles. I'm also the Urban Renewal Agency Manager, and I will be brief. I know that our consultant, Jeff Tashman, has had some conversation with Representative Bailey on this as well, and should be up to speed. This bill is a special fix. It applies to two communities, the City of the Dalles and Lake Oswego. And what it does is allows us to convert from a standard rate plan to a reduced rate plan. As far as I know, there is no opposition to this. I have not heard of any. We've notified Special Districts Association, League of Oregon Cities, and others on this, and have not gotten any negative comments. The bill also is an option, not a requirement of either city, although the City of Dalles would fully intend to move forward with that conversion. It really is essential for our program. We are in the midst of a plan amendment that would extend our plan for another perhaps 10 years, which would allow us to complete the projects that were initially in the plan. We've run out of time and money based on inflation and other factors, and this would allow us to do that without affecting the overlapping taxing districts and, more importantly, the taxpayer. A standard rate plan would add an urban renewal portion or rate to a future bond or option levy. With a reduced rate plan, future bonds and option levies would not have an additional portion added for urban renewal. So the rates for those future bond and option levies would be lower if this bill were to pass and the city would adopt it. And that really concludes my comments. If you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. No questions? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that, and I believe you mentioned this briefly, the change in the rate from the standard rate to the reduced rate is optional for cities to choose whether or not they want to remain on the standard rate or the reduced rate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Careful, Representative.
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Okay, so it's voluntary. It has the effect. Could you go over the effect and why this matters to the two communities for whom it would be an option?
Yes, we're trying to be good partners in our community, and we've talked to all of the overlapping taxing districts, and we are promoting this bill because if we are able to convert to a reduced rate plan, then future bonds, for instance, the fire department may need equipment or buildings or something, those bond rates would only be established then for that particular purpose, and there wouldn't be an additional amount added on that would then convert to the urban renewal program. So it's important from a community perspective, a partnership perspective in the community, that we don't affect those future options and bonds. And
so it's essentially limiting your impact to the parts that you get to control.
That's correct.
Okay. And why is it, this is perhaps a naive question, why is it that only these two cities are affected?
Well, I'm not certain about Lake Oswego, but in our case, back in the late 90s, the legislation that was passed required agencies to establish a maximum indebtedness and a limitation on time. And we did that, and we did it by the deadline. But there was a group of people in the Dalles who opposed the size of the agency more than what we were trying to accomplish. And so they got a referral of that ordinance on the ballot, and the voters voted in favor of the referral, which means the ordinance wasn't effective by the deadline. Mm. And had it been effective by the deadline, we would have been a reduced rate plan. We went through a mediation process. We created a smaller agency, a smaller project list, and that was adopted by ordinance, but after the deadline, and that ordinance stood. There wasn't any referral on that ordinance, and so we fell through a crack that we
as a result of the referral?
Yes.
Okay. Very helpful. Amazed that there aren't any other questions about this. Well, it looks like you've done a good job. I'm still stalling for a minute because I'm afraid as soon as I say thank you and start to conclude, someone's going to come up with a question. But it doesn't look like anyone is. So,
all right.
Appreciate you you being here.
Thank you for the time.
I always get nervous about these kinds of bills because they can get more complicated than they initially appear. Unfortunately, we don't have the fiscal or revenue impact statements, so we can't move this bill today. But given that you are the only person who signed up for the bill, I'll ask if there's anyone else who wants to be heard on the bill. Seeing no indications of interest. Representative Holby, now you're fulfilling my expectations.
I decided to ask a question since you asked for one, and you sort of answered it already, so maybe, but I'm just curious, you say it only affects two municipalities. Are you fairly certain statewide that's all it affects?
Chair Reed, Representative Holby, yes. According to our consultant who works all over the state, just the two cities are involved.
Thank you. Short question.
Thank you. All right. Well, we appreciate you being here. We'll look forward to seeing the fiscal and revenue impact statements shortly and expect to open a work session at that time. So with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 2809. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2181. And we have perhaps a brief summary and someone who's going to help us walk through the amendments that we have, I think.
Is Jeff. It'd be Jeff.
Mr. Keto, sorry for calling you up early.
HB 2121. 2181, excuse me, authorizes local governments to establish local improvement districts to finance energy efficiency and renewable energy improvements for existing homes and some existing commercial buildings. Authorizes local government the ability to assess property owner who obtains a loan under this program to cover a portion of the cost of the program. Authorizes the Oregon Department of Energy, working with Housing and Community Services Department, to establish rules to define types of eligible projects and other considerations. Authorizes DOE to provide loan funds to a local government or directly to property owner in a qualified local improvement district.
And I misspoke saying public hearing when I meant to say work session. So to clarify, we've opened a work session on 2181. Mr. Carroll, please.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jeff Ghetto, Assistant Director, Department of Energy, and I manage the Energy Loan Program. Mr. Chair and committee members, to recap the amendment, at the original hearing, we requested that I take into some comments from some of the other people who testified, which I have done, and other comments that we received at the department. And I have presented them into the document that you have, which is a recap of the amendments. Basically, the commercial building owners on number one, the commercial building owners requested that we look at a limit that was larger than 20,000 square feet, which was somewhat of an arbitrary limit. And looking at it a little bit, closer. We are in agreement to raise that up to 50,000 square foot level for building sizes that could participate in a program that funds energy efficiency from assessments on the property tax statement. Basically, larger buildings than that usually are quite complicated. The measures that go into them, and they require a lot more rigor and a lot more thorough investigation, and probably would use more standardized financing techniques. In number two, the amendment request is to clarify simply that a qualifying project doesn't actually have to all be paid back by a loan. There are other there's other discussion about grant funds, maybe commingled with loan funds, and simply it allows for an ineligible project to be larger in scope, in the sense that only part of it may be paid back from the loan and not the entire amount. In section three, a number of parties asked us to clarify, to make sure that the audits were only done on those properties that were participating versus a local improvement district requesting audits, say, of all the properties. Also, that it was voluntary and that the audits could be paid back, either paid by the local improvement district sponsor, which would be the local government, or it could be included in the funding package. On number four, amendment suggestion request was to, again, clarification by a number of parties requested that the assessment is limited, in fact, to those participating, the qualifying, that have qualifying real property, and also to institute what the word sharing meant by sharing their percentage of the cost, or sharing the cost based upon the property owner's participation in that. In other words, if you had one party that was, say, participating at a $10,000 level and another party at $50,000 level, they would proportionally share based on that participation instead of 50-50, where you split up the assessment. So the assessment directly follows the benefit to specific properties. Also in Section 4, from our Attorney General staff, Jan Pruitt, she noted, and it was actually, this was based on a recommendation originally from Department of Revenue, that there really was not a mechanism that addressed the collection and enforcement of the assessment. And she recommended that one be put in the bill, the 2181, and drafted appropriate language. I'm not a tax expert by any means, so the appropriateness of the language, I just assume, based on her, is better than language I could draft. That was the intent. One of the real key issues with this language, though, is the language is meant to have a collection mechanism that is not subject to Measure 5 limitation. From the way I understand it is that there's a provision in the constitutional amendment dealing with property tax limitation that allows for collection through the tax system of a non-tax item, and that is the intent here, to follow that thread of authority for the collection, and enforcement would be an alternative enforcement mechanism to what other enforcement mechanisms a local improvement district already would have. So, I mean, the intent is very clear, at least from our perspective, that it isn't shouldn't be through a mechanism that would create a Measure 5 limitation issues or subject to compression in regards to property taxes. Measure or number 5 on the list is, it was pointed out to us actually from some people, Seattle Northwest, that does extensive work in obviously issuance and underwriting of bonds for public entities, that the 0.5% was actually a very small amount, and upon research there wasn't a real basis where that 0.5% in the original bill came from, and 3% was a recommended amount. And I did give you in this a kind of a mathematical kind of a summation of what 0.5% would be, so you could get an idea how restrictive that was. And in number 6, the consumer-owned utilities requested that there simply be a provision where is a local government contemplating a local improvement district would be required to notify the serving natural gas and electric utilities. And one might think that obviously if in a small town you kind of know this was happening, you'd see the notifications of it, but it would be possible that the serving utility might be quite distant actually from where a local improvement district would be. So in a way I look at that as obviously common courtesy that they would do that, and this just clarifies that. So we have no opposition to that.
Thank you for the summary. Other questions? Representative Bailey, I saw your hand first, and then Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize, having not seen the amendments beforehand. This may be a dumb question. I'm a little confused. I'm looking through your memorandum that you just walked through with the 6 points on it, and I'm having a hard time mapping that to the proposed -1 amendments. For example, number 5, section 7, discussion of request to increase the limitation to 3% that you just discussed a moment ago, looking in subsection, I assume that refers to section 2, subsection 7 of the amendment that we're looking at. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bailey, actually you're ahead of me a little bit. The March 17th memo that I wrote is in relationship to the original bill, the amendments I got about 15 minutes ago. So they were in reference to the actual bill and not the amended amendments.
Pull up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So to clarify then, the memo that we have, it describes proposed amendments to the actual bill 2181, and these may or may not be contained within the -1 amendment that we've been given.
Is and by correct? Reading this, they appear all to be contained in the -1 amendment.
Then, Paul,
yeah.
Could you please point out for me in the -1 amendment the discussion about the 3% tax rate? Having a hard time finding it.
In the -1 amendment, the section 9 on page 3, basically it says may never exceed 3% of the assessed. So that's the 3%. That's where the 3% is addressed, where previously it was 0.5%.
I was looking for a number rather than the word 3.
Right.
And I was looking under section 7, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Now we got it. Thank you. Go ahead.
So just so I'm clear and for the record, It is your belief that each one of the provisions outlined in your memo is sufficiently contained within the -1 amendment that we've been given?
Yes, it's my belief that that's the case. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. See if I can articulate this. And maybe you went over this in the last hearing, but I think I had to leave early. My question had to do with a homeowner already deciding to replace a furnace, for instance, or windows, or whatever qualifies under this program. And they're going to get a loan. Would the loan be for the differential between what it would have cost us to get regular windows versus some highly super-duper energy-efficient windows, or would it be for the whole project? Maybe that's not something that would be addressed in the bill. Does that make sense at all? I'm trying to figure out how do you figure out what qualifies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, an excellent question, because part of the bill is where we work with housing and look at what actually qualifies for this particular program. Under the current energy loan program, which would use very similar qualifications, if you want to buy energy efficiency, windows, insulation, the entire cost of that could qualify for the loan. When you look at incentives, generally the incentives, another program, but tax credits are generally based only on that incremental difference sometimes in the cost between doing what might be required by code and then also that incremental cost to make it much more energy efficient. We realize on the funding side that if you're going to do it, you have to have money to pay for the whole project. We can't say, well, we're going to pay for a third of it, and you have to just figure out the rest of it. And since the customer is always paying it back, from a practical sense, you really have to have all the funding available for them, for the whole project.
Paula?
Yeah, these programs. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm really out of my element on these things. So if I ask a stupid question, don't be surprised. When it comes to financing, normally that is done by banks. Is there a way that? You're using the sale of the property or a tax lien, I understand, to get your money back. Couldn't that be something opened up to banks to do?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, you're absolutely right. If I can give a couple examples, it might help clarify this. With a local improvement district, the majority of the larger districts will issue their own bonds. They'll do revenue bonds within the local improvement district, just like they would do for if they're doing sewer or sidewalk repairs. So they'll have the authority and they'll use their bonding mechanism. Now, part of the reason they do that is because the intent is the payback on a lot of these projects is very long term. So where a bond might be out for, say, 20 years, the consumer-owned utilities have some wonderful energy efficiency loan programs where they use their local credit union or the bank as the financing vehicle. Almost all of those programs, the payment term is approximately 5 years, 4 or 5 years. So and with the loan program, with the State of Oregon's energy loan program, our typical terms are more in the 10, 15, and about 15 years is a probably average. And again, it's a long-term vehicle because it fills a niche where the only alternative a homeowner generally has is an equity credit line or a second mortgage on their loan on their home, because that's longer term. So we definitely encourage borrowers to use conventional financing mechanisms when they are available. But there are some in the energy world, the payback is fairly small. So a lot of people, to make it affordable for people, you have to stretch the term out. And you simply don't want to stretch the term out too long, depending on the useful life of what your bond buying. Like your car, obviously you wouldn't want to finance your car for much longer than 5 or 6 years at maximum, maybe even less, whereas energy insulation and some home items in the energy world will easily, solar panels now are warranted for 20 years, so you can afford to do it longer term. So we're not trying to compete with the commercial banks. We're actually trying to work with them but fill a very different niche. So actually, we do not anticipate in the agency that we would be funding a lot of the local improvement district work, because we would do it for those districts that didn't have another mechanism to work with. But if they have a local mechanism, either through bonding or financing mechanism, that would work great.
Is that helpful?
It's an alternative only. The use of our program is simply in there as just an alternative, but we don't anticipate that we would probably be financing that much of those particular projects.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Is there anyone who would like to be heard on these -1 amendments in the audience?
Mm-hmm.
I see a couple of hands. Anyone who'd like to come forward, please? And I think, have we distributed those -1 amendments?
We have.
Okay. We have them up here. Are they
There's
available?
There's a handful of copies in the audience.
Okay. If we have additional copies, I think it looks like there are some people who would like to see them. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Annette Spickard. I'm the Lane County Assessor and Tax Collector and the President of the Oregon Association of Tax Collectors. And the association does not take a position on the bill one way or the other, but when we were notified about the amendment, including the property tax system as a method to collect and enforce, I wanted to make sure that you were aware of some of the things that can come up when you use the property tax system to consider if the local improvement district were to use this method, because in reading the amendment, it looks like it's permissive. It just says that they may. First of all, as your presenters noted, it is important that the way that they structure this program and the assessment that they certify to us meets the requirements under Chapter 310, 140. There's specific definitions there that determine whether something is subject to Measure 5 or not, and so that's very important. I do collect special assessments for other improvement districts now within Lane County, and about half of those are subject to Measure 5 compression. So it does happen. Additionally, if we add this to the tax statement, it becomes an annual lien on the property, but it also is subject to the 3% discount if someone pays in full by November 15th, so the local improvement district would need to be aware that this would also be eligible for a discount. They will receive the money as it is collected by us through the uniform distribution schedule, so they would not get a full payment unless the person pays in full, of course, but they would be given the opportunity to pay in thirds just like any other tax. We don't do monthly payment plans, so if they're talking about having the loan repayments come through the tax system, it would just be the one lump sum that's billed out for the loan amount. And I'm unclear from the amendment and the presentation as to whether it's just the cost of the energy audit that they would want us to collect for them, or if it's the actual loan payment over the 10 years or whatever time frame that they would certify to us. Additionally, if it's a lien against the real property, that's to the property, not to the owner. And if they don't pay any portion of their tax, that begins the foreclosure process eventually. And the local improvement district, if they're concerned about collecting on these loans and protecting themselves from default, they would probably need to engage in some dialogue with the county on any properties that were about to enter into the foreclosure process, because I believe the county would be in the first position to take the property, not the local improvement district. So I'm not sure that they could 100% guarantee that this mechanism alone would protect them from any default on the loan. One other item. Also, if they are certifying an assessment to us to collect for them, like I said, it's an annual amount. And so my concern would be that something else is recorded to the property in the county deeds records to notify any potential purchasers that there's an outstanding loan payment on the property, because that won't be reflected on our records. So that's just a suggestion. And that's all I had. I just wanted to make sure that they were aware that if they sort of hitch their wagon to the property tax system, it becomes very complicated and may have some unintended consequences.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any other questions for you? That's helpful information. It appears that we may have some additional conversations to have about that. Mr. Ketter, did you have any thoughts on those issues?
Jeff Ketter, Department of Energy again. Mr. Chair, all of those issues were considered. We understand how the collection is received, and there would be some underwriting done on the participants and on the property to be able to have it structurally work right, so the risks under the program or under any loan repayment were understood. And we also recognize the need for notification for filing of liens for third parties, anybody that's working with properties, the real estate industry, etc.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I probably should have asked you this when you were up earlier, but the qualifying real property definition concept, is it that we only have qualifying real property if the property owner voluntarily obtains the loan? Is that the idea, or is the qualifying real property every house that's within the limited improvement district boundaries?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vance, it's my understanding from reading this that you have a larger universe of qualifying real property, but you have a much smaller universe of those that participate. So what it would mean is if there was a larger commercial building in the property, in the district, they wouldn't be qualifying. I understand the qualifying real property to define your universe of possible properties that could use the program, that they would be subject to being able to get financed. They're located within the boundaries. That's how I read it.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The idea is that the district will encompass a series of, let's say, 10 square blocks of houses or 10 blocks of homes, and then within that 10 blocks or 5 blocks, wherever it might be, different homeowners could step up and say, we would like to utilize the terms of this program. Is that the idea? And then their homes would be appraised, and then their homes would be those that are referred to in paragraph 5.
Yeah.
The local government may access qualifying real property within the district for that property's share of the costs.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Vance, in talking to the I'm not very familiar with the actual formation of local improvement districts. But in talking to the city of Eugene as an example, one of the concerns a local government would have in forming the district is how do you actually cover the administrative costs of doing that? Because costs aren't specified in here how they would do that. And they would envision to be able to do that, you'd probably need a fairly large district, and you'd probably want a significant volume of participants, probably already, that you would anticipate, again, to help cover the costs. But in concept, you're right that there would be a district. I would envision that they'd be quite larger districts than just that small, although I don't know that for a fact at all. And then those, let's say they were all residents, you could potentially have every property within that local improvement district qualifying. So they would be a qualified real property if it was, say, all residential properties. They might be all qualifying. Then those that choose to participate would be able to get an audit, and they would have the assessment would be done for if they voluntarily chose to participate. But yes, they could all be in the definition of qualifying real property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm mindful of the time here. It looks like we've generated some good discussion. I think we're moving in the right direction, but I would be reluctant to do anything with the amendments given the lateness of the hour. So unless anyone objects, I think we'll carry over our work session on 2181 until Thursday and do the same with 2182. Is that sufficient notice? Very good. Representative Holby, are you seeking recognition?
Well, I just have a question, and I guess I can follow up with it later.
Okay. We can continue on Thursday as well.
Yeah.
There aren't any other comments. We appreciate the discussion and everyone's engagement, and we're adjourned.